Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast and this second episode of the Fantasy Production Meeting, where we build the productions we want to see as a down payment to the future. We are...
Alexandra, currently in the UK, and I'm not green.
I'm Sarah in Germany, and I'm super green.
And I'm Liza, also in the UK. My hat is green.
And I'm Robert in Lavenham. And for those watching in black and white, the green is next to the red. We are the Fantasy Production team, and this is our meeting. And today we are looking at George Agreen, the Pinner of Wakefield, attributed to Robert Greene. And Green wrote Green probably around 1591, somewhere in that sort of area. And it seems like it was quite a popular play, and we can understand that. We've done it twice for YouTube now, and we did a slow read-through, and then we did a fast, fun, action-packed play-around read-through, and each time we had a blast. And we think that audiences around the world and across the country should also have a blast as well. But we're not particularly interested in the history in this session. We're more interested in how we're going to produce in our fantasy world of having a budget of how we would want to produce this play today. And if you're inspired by our ideas or would like to keep us in cheese, then you can support our work generally on Patreon, patreon.com/beyondshakespeare, where you can hear the uncut version of this episode. You can hear it early, and even if you're on the correct tier, you can even watch the video and you will then know how many of us are actually green. There's a host of other Patreon-only content and early access stuff available too. But that's enough of that. Let's get down to business. We've got productions to build, and what's the play about? For those who haven't watched all those exciting, lovely, wonderful videos available on YouTube, they are there. You can go and watch them. Those who haven't watched those various videos on Gorgeous George, here is a brief recap of the action. So, what happens in George Agreen? Well, there's a bloke called George. He's a Pinner of Wakefield. But actually, what he is he's really a freedom fighter in disguise. He's a big fanboy of Robin Hood, and he goes out and he rights wrongs. So, someone turns up locally and tries to push their weight about with a royal charter, and he forces the poor bugger to eat the royal charter. Meanwhile, the king of Scotland and England are at each other's throats. Bad things are going down. There are rebels on the English side, and George deals with some of the rebels through some cunning cosplay. And there's a big battle between the two kings, the King of England, King of Scotland. They have a battle, the Scots lose, and the English king gets together with the Scottish king and goes, well, we've heard a lot about George the Green, let's go and visit George the Green. Meanwhile, other people have been hearing about George the Green, including Robin Hood. Robin Hood is a bit worried about his reputation at the moment, because there's this upstart called George Agreen, and they end up meeting and fighting, and then George Agreen goes, oh my god, you're Robin Hood, oh that's so cool, and they sort of join forces, and they wander off together and happen to coincide with the arrival of the disguised kings of Scotland and England, and there's a big quarterstaff fight with lots of people to do with the whole thing about trailing your staff along the ground, at which point, the end of which, you get the kings going, oh, yeah, George the Green, you're great. And they go, oh, you're the king, you're great. And then they all have beer and they all live happily ever after. Lots of stuff happens. It's really silly. It's a bit like Robin Hood, except that the central character isn't Robin Hood, but Robin Hood then turns up. So it's also got Robin Hood as well as George the Green. And it's really fun. And there are fart jokes. Hey. And everybody lives happily ever after, after lots of fights. Yeah, so feeding into the whole Robin Hood tradition of a script being an excuse for a series of extended fight scenes, which I absolutely adore. It's really funny. It's really fun. There's lots of disguising, lots of costumes, lots of silliness.
Next time I do this, I'm going to bring a quarterstaff.
Okay, so we move on to question two as we start getting into the actual what are we going to do with this play? What sort of venue, what sort of media do you want to be doing? Are we working in theatre, film, interpretive dance? What's your production going to be about? And we're going to Alexandra first on that one. And then we'll go around the room.
My production leans heavily on the things outside the production, because what I imagine this kind of being part of is a greater festival of things of the period and historical information and food and, oh my goodness, lots of food. There is so much mention of food in this play that there must be, you know, everything from Kendallmann cakes and how to make your own seals and all that stuff.
And beer. There is a lot of ale in this play as well. Yeah.
Beef. There's quite a lot of beef as well.
And so historical kind of or period-related information, but relayed in that sort of fun and engaging and kind of interactive way. Food, the kind of activities that people would have had, the sort of, you know, the actual life in these times. Shoemaking, etc. Quarterstaff fighting of the stage, combat variety, etc., etc. Lots of things that...
You're not looking for any kind of additional work there in terms of teaching stage, teaching combat in between this at all, are you?
I mean, it's either that or cooking, and I'd rather teach the thing that I can't kill people with. So, yes. The idea being that this would be much like a Renaissance fair or what the Tower of London did a few years ago, where they had a sort of a night school with a K. This would be angled towards children in particular and parents as well. And it would be, you know, a fun day out or kind of thing on the village green that you can access for a few days. That would be outdoors in a few places. And as part of that, you would have this production. With all the fun, outdoorsy, interactive wonderfulness. And you could take that around the general area that gets referred to in the play. So, you know, there's obviously Wakefield, there's Bradford. But very excitingly, there is a village called Robin Hood that's only, and as I understand it, about 15 minutes drive from Wakefield. So the tour just writes itself.
Yes, and there's a lot. There's a big Robin Hood fan community. When I googled this play, actually, there's a fandom wiki, and this play does actually feature on it. So I was really pleased. You know, the Robin Hood community, you know, does know of this text. So
that's fabulous. Welcome, Robin Hood fans.
Yes, welcome. This will probably be much to your dismay. So we've got, as part of a festival with sort of extended fronds of other activities branching out, who wants to leap in with theirs? Sarah wants to leap in with her pitch.
I would like to leap in with my pitch because it would kind of go really well with Alexandra's pitch, I think. Although I have thought about doing it in one specific place because I used to do a lot of site-specific theatre, and I was the writer in residence for a year for an amazing old walled orchard for in a city called Ripon, which is actually in North Yorkshire, sadly, not West Yorkshire. But there's a charity there called the Ripon Wall Garden, and I'm just going to give them a little shout out because they're wonderful. They do a lot of work with children and adults with learning disabilities, and they have also restored this beautiful old walled garden that used to be the garden of a bishop's palace, and it's a bit of a secret gem. Very few people know it's there. You can go and wander around it. It's very idyllic, and it's full of these really old twisted apple trees and pear trees, and some of them are so old they actually contain varieties of fruit which have died out elsewhere in the country, and these are the last, you know, trees where you can go and actually experience and eat this fruit. So they have this very idyllic orchard, and I just think it would be great. I wrote a few pieces for them, and we did them as promenade performances where you walked around the orchard. The audience walked around the orchard. They were guided. Well, actually, no, one of them, they just wandered around and found people randomly. But the way I would envisage this would be they would be guided round the orchard, and I have a particular character in mind who would do that, which we'll come to later. And what I would like to do is actually use the greenery. So, for example, like if you had, I'm thinking of this particular orchard, there were quite a few trees, not the really old precious ones, but some of the younger ones. They were quite low, you know, they had split trunks. So there were big branches coming off, so they were quite easy to climb. You know, you could use a tree as John O'Barley's castle. So you could have Jane like perched in the tree and James below, or, you know, and then if you had like a sort of big bush, you know, big bushes quite often have hollow bits in the middle. And again, I'm thinking of this particular orchard, you could have Grimes's house. Grimes' house could be, you know, this sort of like in the greenery. So he pops out of the greenery, you know, to sort of surprise the audience. And I was thinking, you know, Jenkin could be the one who leads the audience round. So then it becomes quite an interactive thing for the audience because, for example, Act 3, Scene 3, like it opens with George moping, basically. He's having a little soliloquy to himself, and then Jenkin comes upon him and speaks. So Jenkin could actually take the audience, and the audience could kind of, you know, we could be peering around the tree and spying on George while he's doing his soliloquy, and then Jenkin goes and joins him. So he goes from the audience, he leaves the audience, and obviously he still stays in character when he's with the audience, but then he suddenly goes into the action. So the audience feel really close to it. And then you've got things like the when Jenkin meets the shoemaker and they're going to fight, but it's like, oh, let's walk to the other end of the street. So, you know, they could walk to the other end of the street and the audience could follow them through the orchard. And the fight scenes are so amazing. You could make the most of those by, you know, the audience could then surround the fighters and they could be cheering and booing and hissing and, you know, oh, go on, go for him, and heckling. So it could really all become part of it, lots of audience interaction. And then I was thinking, when after the fighting's all over and George then he has this line where he says, a stand of ale to be set in the marketplace that all may drink that are athirst this day. And you could at that point, you know, those tiny, tiny little paper cups you get them in fast food restaurants, putting the sauce in, or like, you know, you could pass those out, those tiny little cups with just a little tiny bit of ale, and you could pass them out around the audience, so the audience all get to go, oh, huzzah, and drink the ale. So I think that would be quite and also, I mean, the play actually ends in a song, and if you did a song, you could actually again hold up a board with the chorus on and get the audience to join in the chorus. So it's like you're taking some of the kind of interactive elements from pantomime. You're not turning the play into a pantomime, because I think the play is too beautiful for a pantomime, really. But you're taking some of those interactive elements that work and kind of weaving them in to kind of create that kind of joyful bond between the audience and the players. And I think that would kind of really work in this like lovely bucolic green setting, because, I mean, there's not any actual magic in the play, but it is a real folk tale. So I think that would be a really lovely way to stage it. So it could be done in this place that I'm thinking of, in the beautiful Ripplemore Garden, but it could be done in any orchard. I'm sure there are orchards around Wakefield. And I actually think it would tie in really well with Alexandra's brilliant festival idea, because you could have the whole festival in the orchard or in the garden or in beautiful grounds, and then, you know, the play's there, and then Alexandra's there, you know, teaching staff fighting like in the breaks, and we're all drinking our ale, and it just the whole thing turns into just a really good day for everybody. So yeah, that's my pitch.
I take your contract, Sarah. It's the sort of thing that you could, you're absolutely right. You could do, you know, some variation of what I was suggesting and or what you were suggesting, and you could take that to anywhere that's, you know, a public place that doesn't get you, a public green place that doesn't get used for communal and community activities, but really should.
Yeah.
You know? You were saying something about having things happen around the trees and using the trees as part of that. And I was just thinking, when you mentioned that, one could build, you know, very simple, very easily removable sort of bits of set, let's say, you know, where you've got a wall between two trees and that's someone's house. And then the memory of that stays, but the object itself doesn't do anything to, you know, the environment, doesn't affect the space that much.
We did that actually I did a one production with them. It was sort of like a subversion of the Snow White story, obviously, because there are a lot of apples. And actually the people who are involved with the charity, they do a lot of the young people and adults who the charity supports, they do a lot of woodworking and whatnot. And they built us a castle, like just a flat, it was just a flat panel. And it was just really, really lovely. And it set up, it was set up in the green, and yet didn't do any harm to anything, but it was just a really nice thing. So yeah, that would work really well. Great idea.
Lovely. Liza, what's your... I think we should say to the audience, last episode we went for quite radically different takes. We had a discussion before we went on saying we may be a lot more crossovery this time, and that's fine. So worry you not, this regular listeners to this episode too.
Yes. Well, my thought would be... And again, this has intersections and dovetails probably with Sarah's and Alexandra's. My thought would be a scratch touring production that you could basically play anywhere. Possibly you wouldn't even need a stage. Basically any open space. It could play outdoors, it could play indoors, school gyms, empty fields, garden centers.
Pub.
You'd need enough space to have a quarterstaff fight would be my criterion.
Pub garden.
So pub or pub car park or pub garden could work. This is a play with a working class hero. Let's bring it back to the people. And also there are so few plays that set specifically in the north of England. So let's bring this play back to the north of England. Let's bring it to Wakefield, bring it to Bradford, bring it to all the towns that used to be little towns and are now probably like suburbs of Manchester or something. But just tour it around the north to people who don't normally get this kind of play. Get funding from some benevolent body so we can charge a ridiculously low ticket price but still pay our artists a fair wage. That's the dream, right? But the important thing is that anyone be able to come to this. And it's a play that lends itself to that, I think. I could see a very sort of homemade ethos to the sets and costumes. You basically just need quarterstaffs and a couple of crowns. Jaina Barley appearing on her balcony is something you could, I guess, work out depending on what your venue was. Or just make a balcony out of cardboard and ask the audience to imagine it.
Anything can be a rampart, right?
A cardboard flat with a stepladder behind it or something.
I've been a rampart.
You've been a rampart?
Yeah, yeah, well, it happens. It happens sometimes. Yeah.
Rob, leave your personal life out of this. And so, yeah, scratch touring production in, my thought would be scruffy medieval, which leaves us scope to go, you know, for some interesting costumes when Willie disguises himself as a woman, for example, or when George disguises himself as a fortune teller.
So my pitch is, again, we're all talking about live theatre because, you know, it's what's on our minds at the moment. I did toy with trying to persuade Disney to do an animated version so that we could reuse the fox and the Robin Hood characters there. But then I thought, you know, there's fantasy and then there's it would be a travesty of the original cartoon, not of this play. My theatrical idea is, I agree, it's not quite a pantomime, but it does have certain panto vibes to it. Mm. And my idea is that it functions within our repertoire, as it were, as a summer panto, as a big summer show. So I'm sort of looking at it, leaning into the panto aesthetic, number one touring venues, especially in the north, and really going large with the scale of the show and really enjoying it. It's interesting, even though I've mostly worked in fringe theatre, I think it's my curse, is that deep down all I want to do is light entertainment. And and yet I'm always playing to two people and a dog. So extravaganza. The aesthetic, I think I think we've talked about, everyone sort of mentioned this in passing, of almost everything is two-dimensional set-wise in this play. It's just something about this play that it's shiny but 2D. And so they would be big, extravagant sets, but they would actually be relatively two-dimensional. They'd fly in, move in and out. The action would constantly move. And, of course, we'd lean into the scale of the fight scenes. We would really go big on that, and we probably put some more in. I mean, there's supposed to be a small war at one point. I don't see any reason why we can't have a bit of that, just to break up some of the scenes and lean into the comedy and just make it good, the good kind of populist entertainment that that your big venues would perhaps like. You know, there aren't many plays that we do where we could say we could take this out and market it to a big space in the way that that other entertainments can. So that's very much my thought, is to go big. Go big.
You could pitch that idea, seriously, you could pitch that idea to the West Yorkshire Playhouse, because the main stage in the West Yorkshire Playhouse is large, and they would love that, actually.
Mm. Add some music, more lights. It's just and you know, it wouldn't be cheap, but you know, it's that thing of there should be an audience for something like that, so you can balance your books and make sure that you create something exciting. So we've got festival outdoors, site specific outdoors, scratch. Indoors, outdoors, and I've gone resolutely indoors because I'm a lighting designer. And leafy gobos, more leafy gomos than meets the eye.
Actual leaves.
Leafy Gobos is the name of my new band. We're very sort of psychedelic with a bit of sort of acid rock.
Yeah,
nice.
Like it.
Think Gong, but different, leafier.
Okay, so we move to question three, focusing in on some of the characters that we particularly love in this play, maybe thinking about some of the casting for it, just to reiterating the elements of the plot by talking about them in terms of character, and what might that say about our production. Sarah gets to go in first on some of the characters.
Yes, so obviously I'm going to start with George Green, and as the only Yorkshire person in the room, I'm highly excited by George, because he's basically a Yorkshire Errol Flynn, and Yorkshire people never get to be Errol Flynn. So, yeah. So I would absolutely want, you know, as Liza said, you know, he's working class. I would want an actor. He would be a working class hero in green tights, probably. He's a very vigorous chap. Fond of settling disputes with his staff rather than, you know, talking them through in a considered way. But he's not above using a bit of guile, you know, dressing up in disguise to foil his enemies. So he's an interesting character, actually, because he balances all the sort of daring do with a sort of like a robust practicality. And that makes him very, very human, I think. And he is quite hot-headed as well. It's funny, sometimes he really thinks about things and plots and goes into detail, and sometimes he's just very, very spontaneous, and that makes him so human, and I just love him for that. His lady love, Betris, is also great. I mean, there are the one criticism I have of this play, but I mean, it's just par for the course with the era, is that there are so few women in it. And I am a great fan of cross-casting plays in general, so I would definitely be doing cross-casting with some of these characters. But Betris is a great match for George, I think, because she's also, you know, dynamic and courageous. You know, she's not above defying her father and sneaking out of his house in disguise to be with the man she loves. She's also, though, eminently sensible. And she sees matters in a very practical light. You know, George is saying, oh, when are you going to come and live with me? And she's like, yeah, my father, have you met him? So I think, you know, George probably needs someone quite sensible, because he is quite a hothead. So they're just a really nice match. Then you've got the Robin Hood Brigade, Robin and Marion, and then Much and Scarlet. And I mean, they don't really need any introduction. That's the whole joy of them. Everybody knows who they are already. Liza mentioned the fanboying earlier, and that is something that I absolutely love. George idolizes Robin Hood. So there's some really delightful stuff when once he realizes who Robin is, he's like, oh my God, you're my favorite person ever in the whole world. And it's fabulous and very, very funny. But I think it's important that it actually happens after they've fought, because by that point, you know, George has actually matched Robin Hood in combat. So on some kind of gur off alpha male level, he's proved that they're equals. So Robin respects him. And once that principle has been established, then George gets to kind of man crush all over him in this really hilarious way. And that just makes it really charming, because they are actual equals and they do become friends in spite of all of the fanboying. So that's really lovely. Someone, when we did the second reading, someone, I think it might have been Stephen, mentioned that this could be a slightly, one where you could cast Robin Hood as a slightly more mature Robin Hood. And I think that's a great idea because, you know, then you've got the, he doesn't have to be really, really old, but just the sort of slightly more mature experience, you know, experience contrasted with youth. You've got George there, who's the really enthusiastic, you know, vigorous young guy, and he hero worships Robin Hood, and then Robin's the kind of the older, more mature guy who's maybe feeling his age a bit when he meets George. I don't know, that could work quite well.
I just want to jump in on that. Thinking about the Robin Hood trying to protect his legacy. You know, you've got the next generations coming up behind him, and Marion's there just going, you know, you're not getting the bookings you used to.
Yeah, absolutely. That would actually explain some of Marion's
angst. Yeah. You know, the franchise is in danger. I think that creates a dynamic to the fight as well. Which the kind of thing that Alexandra might be very interested in. I'm not suggesting that you're pivoting in any way in the direction of the fights, but maybe you are.
No, well, you said fight, and my light just dramatically went out and back on. So it was, yes, it clearly wants me to be noticed. I also think narratively, it's a great thing that is never done, showing us the hero after their glory days, where we've invested ourselves, and you can get an audience with my festival production, you can get an audience invested in the Robin Hood idea, and then you see them and they're past their best, and that's okay. And that's actually interesting. And yeah, I feel like that would be a great angle into a Robin Hood mythos that no one seems to have taken yet.
Well, there's a film, isn't there, with Sean Connery and I want to say Audrey Hepburn. It can't be Audrey Hepburn.
It was
Audrey Hepburn. Yeah, playing Marion, where he's older. But in a way, that would actually also feed into it, you know. So, can I talk about Jenkin?
Please talk about Jenkin. Talk about the clown.
Jenkin's one of my favourite characters because he's the clown. So he provides the comedy business. But he's also genuinely helpful in the way not all clowns are. Some are. Hodge, for example, in Thomas Cromwell, he's a really helpful clown. But Jenkin is genuinely helpful. He's sort of there. He's there assisting him when he's foiling the baddies in disguise. You know, he's passing him his staff. He's bringing Betrus to George. So the fact that he's genuinely, you know, he's a clown. He's really, really funny, but he's also genuinely helpful. I think that just makes him a character that the audience are going to really root for. And so he is the one. If I was going to do this like promenade performance where a character was leading the audience around, you know, an orchard or a wood, he's the one who I would have as the go-between, because I think the audience would really, really get behind him.
Yes, he's not comedy clown. He's wisecracking sidekick clown.
Yeah.
You know, he gets some really nice lines of dialogue, as I recall.
He
does make some fart jokes. You know, that's an important leveler if you've got children in the audience.
I'd never
underestimate the power with a younger crowd of a fart joke.
Absolutely.
Might need to put more in, actually.
Yeah.
If you're going for children. I'd probably go from a 12 plus range myself in terms of that. Yeah, anyone else want to pile in on Jenkin, because it's a really interesting question what the one does with the character, the comedy characters and things. Anyone want to pile in on him or any of the other characters Sarah's already mentioned as well? George himself. Gorgeous George. How gorgeous does Gorgeous George need to be? I think Gorgeous George needs to be very gorgeous. I mean, leaning into the, you know, I wouldn't quite go for Love Island runoff, but because he does need to be good as a performer. So maybe strictly first round, second round knockout, you know, that sort of area. I feel might be very important.
Well, I can't speak for their handsomeness, but I agree with Sarah on the idea of these characters looking and sounding and feeling local to the people who are, you know, who are there to watch, whether it's on a big stage, like Rob was saying, or you know, out on the village green. It needs to feel like this is our hero, this is, you know, these are my people, as a vibe for the play. And, you know, it would be interesting if you do this with, I'm guessing this is possibly the opposite of what Robert is going to propose for casting, but I would very much go for unknowns, for, you know, actors who can bring that locality because they actually have it, not necessarily being from two towns away, but, you know, actors of Yorkshire. And aiming for something that is kind of intangible, because again, my version of things has a lot of interaction and has a lot of kind of additional historical information. It's that intangible thing of the person you are speaking to sounding like they know the thing they're talking about inside out, because they do. And that doesn't mean that they have to be an expert in the thing specifically that they're teaching or kind of being involved in. So I don't necessarily think that you would have to have something like what Past Pleasures does, for example, where you've got, you know, actors in character, the character is quite possibly a real person, a documented real person, and they're there to, you know, teach you how to make a thing, how to cook. But in respect of the performance, we need to feel as though on that side of things, we need to feel as though these are really genuine, complete humans.
Following on from that point, I mean, George is going to be a tough role to cast because you need, I've so far come up with three qualities that your George needs. And one is a good stage combatant. Believably physically agile and open-hearted enough to have that kind of heroic aura. But in terms of competence as an actor, a good stage combatant who can handle the quarterstaff fighting. Secondly, he will need, whoever you cast, that actor will become somehow the heart of the company. So, you know, even though this is... It's a play, it's a job, it's pretend, but there is a psychology to who your central actor is. So that person will need to be a good colleague and a generous sort of personality, and generally a sort of up for it person. Thirdly, and this is my criterion, if I were casting this play, this is the only role that I would mandate a certain ethnicity, which would be not a white dude. I agree with Alexandra that having someone who's authentically Northern would be desirable. But there are plenty of people who are authentically Northern who are also not white dudes.
Yeah, I completely agree with you as well. And also the to Sarah's point of mixing around gender. As well.
Yeah,
I was going to say he doesn't even have to be a dude.
Have anything to do with northernness?
You're right. Dude is not. You know, if we find our George and our George, you know, Georgeness transcends.
That's one of those intersecting panto things. You know,
exactly.
Panto does give you the full range of playing around with gender roles, which makes life easier.
So the reason I would not. The reason that I would mandate not a white dude as George is because of a speech that George has in their first scene, which is the speech where the traitorous earls try to get him to join the rebellion. And George says, "You of the bench and you, my fellow friends," which, you know, includes the audience, "neighbors, we, subjects all unto the king, we are English born. And therefore Edward's friends, vowed unto him, even in our mother's womb, our minds to God, our hearts unto our king, our wealth, our homage, and our carcasses be all King Edward's. Then, sirrah, we have nothing left for traitors but our swords." That speech, it seems to me, in the hands of a white dude, if you were a person of unsavory politics, you could put an interpretation on that. Which would not necessarily be our goal as a production, which might be actively in conflict with our goals of inclusivity and bringing theater to the people. And the people most emphatically include all the people.
Now for a little break, little moment of Georgia Green goodness in liquid form. Over to Sarah for Cocktail Minute.
Legal disclaimer.
We accept no liability as to how this drink affects your internal organs or views on the nature of reality.
All recipes are followed at the listener's own risk. Don't have nightmares.
And now, over to Sarah and Cocktail Minute.
So, the Georgia Green cocktail. For this recipe, you will need a cucumber.
Does the cucumber symbolize a quarterstaff?
It could very well do, actually. Ooh. Although I've only got half a quarter staff, which is a little bit inadequate. But
that's like an eighth staff.
Yeah, yeah. So you'll need a sort of chunk of cucumber, which you want to slice up and put into a cocktail shaker. And then you will need an apple, and you want to cut a slice off this, and you want to peel it. You want to peel the slice that you've just got the inside flesh of the apple. Cut that up, put it in your cocktail shaker. Then you will need one of these for measuring, and you will need a bottle of vodka.
Yay!
Yay! And you want 50 mils of vodka, and you put that into your cocktail shaker, and then you want to give it a little mix now. So, you know, you haven't put anything else in yet, but you want to give it a mix just so that the cucumber and the apple infuse into the vodka. And if you've got time and you're not massively impatient and desperate for a drink, as I usually am by the time I'm making a cocktail, you could actually put this in the fridge for 10 minutes or half an hour or a few hours if you have that much willpower, just to let the vodka infuse with the apple and the cucumber. Then you want 30 mils of ginger wine, and all the ginger wine that I know of comes from Scotland, so King James would have been very approving of that. And then you want to add 25 mils of, it's a Japanese melon liqueur, but it's called Midori, and you want to add that in, and then you add the juice of half a lime. And you put all that in your cocktail shaker. You then add ice. This is where you add the ice. You give it a good shake, blend it all together, pour it out, and then you end up with this.
What is that?
That is the George Green cocktail. So this is, yeah, apple and cucumber infused vodka with, I've garnished it with a slice of cucumber because I think it looks nice, but you could actually use a slice of apple, which would be useful if there were any passing horses that you needed to, you know, get out of your pound as you were sipping. So yes, the Georgia Green cocktail. Cheers.
Soupy twist. A full ingredients and instruction list should be available via the show notes. I say should, I don't know if it will. Anyway, yeah, so, yeah, talking about, you know, what we do with this text, what we do with this in rehearsal, what we do with the script, do we change anything, do we adapt? What I really like about this script is it is very well written, but it doesn't show off. You know, it is not saying, look how fine my language is. It tells the story, it tells it rather well, there's some lovely lines, but it doesn't get in the way of telling the story, which for a piece of entertainment is actually incredibly important. And especially if you're trying to do an outdoor performance, you need something which carries information, which doesn't do extended simile and metaphor, because in an outdoor environment, you're screwed with that. I mean, there are ways around that and things, but the way this story is told really helps on that level very nicely. So by and large, actually, there's not a lot in here that I would say cut. I have got a note again on Jenkin of that question of, you know, depending on the nature of the clown, depending on the nature of the actor who needs to be very good at comedy, whether there's some retooling, maybe fairly minor retooling, but there might be some of the way the jokes are delivered just might get slightly twinged around the edges. But as a text, you know, it's short. The only active cut I'd like to do is actually just not emphasize the number of people who die horribly. Because halfway through the play, there's this massive battle, and the king comes on and says, well, we've just killed 30,000 people. And, you know, it's just a very minor thing. But, you know, all you really need is him to come on and say, we won. That'll be fine. Because, you know, everybody lives happily ever after, pretty much, otherwise. You know, there is an onstage death. I might want to tweak that. And in terms of rehearsal process, this is very much one all focusing on storytelling. Focusing on those set pieces, the fights, the music. It's a matter of getting together, and this is where the question three and question four sort of intersects, is getting, you know, people who work very well with this kind of material, which is why, again, I should point out, I'm not aiming for a panto, but I do think personnel for panto would be very good for this. And not necessarily the big names, but, you know, the people who do panto every year who you know, can do the singing, can do the dancing, probably can do fighting, you know, if they're good physically, and can work a crowd on some level. And that's where making sure the team works together, because it's, you know, yes, there is George, there is this focus on some characters, but actually the whole totality of it all needs to slot together incredibly well. Who wants to leap in on any of their rehearsal processes, if there is any? I mean, we can skip on if anyone is lost for words or just has other things they want to say. Sarah?
The thing I would be tempted to cut is the number of rebel nobles, because there's four of them. There's Kendall, Armstrong, Bonfield and Mannering. And I'm like, they're all just really inept villains. And do we really need four? So I don't know, like, I would be tempted to look at the text and see if I could maybe amalgamate a couple of them. The other person I wanted to talk about in the character section, but we kind of moved away from that, is Jaina Barley. Because she, I mean, Liza mentioned what a great character she is. And I feel, you know, George is the hero of the play, but she is the other hero of the play. She has a lot to contend with. I think it's a shame that she's only in that one scene. And I think it's a particular shame because you've got James, who's a lecherous old goat, King James, leching after her. And, you know, and then, you know, he's called away and, oh, great, she's going to be fine. And then right at the end, King Edward, who up until this point has appeared to be quite a sort of wise and just king, suddenly has this line where he's like, oh yeah, and I want to go and have a look at this woman, Jaina Barley, who James is you know, keen on, because ooh, she sounds like a bit of all right. And it's like, dudes, just leave her alone, you know. So I think either I'd want to cut that line because it does actually creep me out slightly, or alternatively leave that line in and actually have Jane coming back on at the end. She doesn't even need any dialogue maybe, but she just kind of, you know, walks in with Ned in tow, grabs somebody's staff on the way past and just like, yeah, whacks him around the head and says, you know, I married you, Olga, or just whacks him around the head and just coolly walks on.
Yes, because it is an interesting sort of weird annex to the story of this incident that thing does go nowhere. I mean, most other elements of this play are integrated into each other, and that
they
one isn't.
Come round.
And maybe there is a thing about tidying that up or making more of that. Alexandra?
Relating to Sarah's point about why are there so many people who say very little and but, you know, don't add much, I felt that way about Robin's crew, right? Where we meet a whole bunch of people who go, I am this person, and because you know everything about me, I'm not even going to bother doing anything other than give you my name. Let's have a fight. Let's have a pint. Excellent. So one, you know, with those characters, you get around that by having an established mythos and by leaning into that in, you know, outside of the production itself. But also, you could make that a thing. You know, you could have the three or four either actors, or if you cut down the lines and you end up with them being basically two-liner characters, audience participation, promote some people to other rebels, right? So you could either have the three, let's say, performers who are and company for the rebels and then for the heroes and then etc. But there's actually one character, there's one construction that gets used by Kendall and Much, who both say more than once, as I am my name of that place. So that sort of thing would be, as I say, would be fun to do either if you're using it as audience interaction or just the same people. So you've seen the face that said, I am Kendall, now saying I am Much. The other thing is, going back to Rob's point about language, the language of this play lends itself to being understood really well, which is wonderful for children, again, but also for people who are not into that kind of thing. The script seems to show us, in most cases, but not all of them, that violence is not a solution. James turns up outside the Abarly castle and threatens to kill the little boy, and he doesn't get what he wants as a result of that, and he also doesn't kill the little boy. The quarterstaff fights, they end up with, "Who? Good, you are a worthy opponent," you know. again, if there were tailoring of the script or of the performance of the interpretation that kind of really indicates that, you know, we've all learned how to wave a stick around in order to pretend to hurt people. But as you can see, we're pretending and we're having fun pretending together, as opposed to this actually being a thing that solves our problems, which is why I agree with Robert about the kind of genuine greater consequences of war. The fact that the plot at the end gets resolved with everybody forgiving everybody and having a pint, like, that's great.
There's picking up on your point about things to emphasise, the script constantly does this, and I think you could do more with it, is people saying the same thing in a line. So give your man leave to fetch me my staff. Jenkin, fetch him his walking staff. Here is your walking staff. And again, which really lends itself to outdoor stuff, because it's like, this thing is happening now. We're now, go and knock on the door. I will knock on the door. I have knocked on the door. And which is also, you know, likely comic, but it's also quite useful. Liza.
It lends itself to distance as well, doesn't it? Because you're going, tell him to do the thing. The person who's, you know, further along the crowd goes, yeah, he has to do the thing. And then at the other end of the crowd, you've got the person receiving the information. So yeah, that could be.
Yeah, I do kind of enjoy the repetition in this play. And I feel like rather than cut it, leaning into would be fun. Just as, you know, there's no power on earth that could make the comedy less stupid. So you have to lean into it to make it extra fun. When Sarah was talking about Jane Abarley, I thought in the first Wakefield scene, there's a justice who runs the village and confers with George and never comes back after that scene. What if the justice is Jane Abarley and she's basically the president of the village?
Oh, nice.
Maybe we can find some other lines later in the play to also give her, so that character stays alive. But I think the basic mechanic of dastardly earls double Robin Hood's men, Jane Abarley doubles Maid Marian, I think that basically works. The only argument I can think of towards having extra rebels is that you need understudies. Especially if I'm doing a scratch tour, someone is bound to go down with flu or you know, get an ingrown toenail or something. If you're doing a scratch tour, you have to be friends with chaos. And so you have to have people prepared to cover and jump in. Yeah, we need a really good fight director, because how to stage quarterstaff fights without breaking a finger, padded gloves for all our quarterstaff fighters, I think is going to be a necessity.
And there are things to do with safety. Sorry, really quickly. There are things to do with safety that would be genuine considerations in a show with this many fights, that are to do with costume elements, like what shoes people wear and spacing and keeping people away from the audience. And if you do have any audience interaction, making very clear delineations between now you stay over there and now you're allowed to take part and all that. But they are things that are doable and that have been done.
It's almost the point where it's a shame we haven't got a film pitch, because, you know, the crazy 88 sequence of at the end with the shoemakers, it's a massive pylon. It is literally just let's have as big a fight scene as you have the facilities to make happen, because there is no limit to how many people could be in that fight scene. It would be fab if actually you've got a company that is actually massive. If you could afford to have that level of carnage safely administered. And now a little interlude as we enter the chat room. Enter the chat room. We've already looked at this wonderful play twice on YouTube in our various exploring sessions, where we use the chat room to enter into the deeper world of the play and look for the more intellectual aspects that we can share and celebrate with you now. And so, as we enter the chat room, we're going to find out what the deepest and most intelligent thinkers of the world think about this play as they read it. So now, join us as we enter the chat room.
Enter Mint Cake.
Yes.
Tell the truth, I was cuddling my dog.
I love that movie.
Some Viagra for Grime, please, one.
No, but he's perfect.
We were mucking around with all the accents.
I am offended at its lack of offensiveness.
I love them.
Yes.
George, George, I love you, but you really need to stop fanboying on Robin and get a grip.
Yes.
This is what you need. Brilliant comedy violence.
Huzzah!
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Yes, please.
Yes.
True story.
Hashtag justice for Ned.
And that was the important message from the chat room. We'll now leave the chat room and return you to your regular content. We're going to go to our favourites now. Favourites line, favourite speeches, favourite characters. It's a free-for-all round, as it were, I feel. Free-for-all round. And, we're going to see what favourite speeches, what favourite lines. I'm going to go in first on this one because it's a free-for-all. You can try and stop me if you like. Anyone can have a go to stop me. But whose pretty boy art thou is still my favourite line for its deeply inappropriate. Of-ness. I like that one very much. Anyone got some favourites?
I have a favourite. It's not a line. I have a moment which I favour immensely, which is the couple's resolution at the end, where we've got, you know, the approval of the match between George and Beatrice. Yes, you're fine. Okay, our hero gets the girl. But she's shown herself not to be just, you know, the girl. In this, through as someone else was saying, I can't remember if it was Liza or Sarah, you know, what her aims in life are, and so that's it. There's something that needs to be very clearly but briefly emphasized as to how well matched they are together, and we get that in the Beatrice magic appearance moment episode, where they don't want valuables, and they, you know, she's refused people offering her not a kingdom but whatever. He's refused a knighthood. But more importantly is the match. I'm really keen on the match between Grime and Willie, because the text is ambiguous, but it's ambiguous enough that you can, without any effort, make it sort of clear that actually they've figured out that they're both men and they're both okay with that, and they still want to be together, and that's fine. Or that's just as normal as the other match. And I feel like, especially when you do that as a performance, I was saying, aimed at children, just normalize that everyone, you know, that not all Northerners are white, and that, you know, some people are gay, and all of these things that exist in the world around us nowadays, even though you're doing this in highly specific 1480s garb.
Yep, lovely. Other favourites?
My favourite scene is also, well, I've written here, the Wily reveal. Yeah, because I would absolutely want to play it the same way that Alexandra has just described. I just do want to put in a thing here, though. Is he Wily or is he Willy? I personally feel, I know Willy is more, you know, hilarious, and I have never been known to wittingly ignore a double entendre, but I actually feel he's Wily because he's a Wily character. And so I would go for Wily. My line, in addition to the one you had, Rob, which I also had, I'll baste you both so well you were never better basted. I love that line because obviously he's talking about violence, but I just, turkeys come to mind. So, you know, put it on your Christmas mug. And also it's a great tongue twister. Since I started doing these readings with you guys, I've been collecting Tudor tongue twisters to use with my voice clients. And that is definitely going in there because it's a great one.
One of the things I love about this play, what caught my imagination was how unashamedly silly this play was. And the first time that this play really ascends into the heights of silliness, because our first scene, as you recall, is with the dastardly rebellious earls who are planting their banner and saying they intend to rebel and throw down the king and rule the kingdom. And it's a pretty standard scene for a play of this era. You could, you know, you're expecting a pretty straightforward history play, rebels rebel, kings fight rebels, rebels thrown down. Then you get the scene where Mannering goes to Wakefield and waves his large commission around, and George stands up and forces him to eat the seals off his commission. And from that scene forward, you feel like this play could go anywhere. And you're in genuine suspense because anything could happen. Like, nothing is sacred in this play.
Yes, so, I love the way Mannering just goes, for see, I have a large commission.
And he whips it out and waves it around.
And somebody eats it, so yeah.
What George says is, "What, are you in color? I will give you pills to cool your stomach. Seest thou these seals? Now by my father's soul, which was a yeoman when he was alive, eat them, or eat my dagger's point, proud squire." Which I think that is the point where the play nails its colors to the mast as the incredibly stupid comedy that it's going to become. Yes. Well, I do like the joke that Jenkin tells about the other guy forcing him to hold his horse while he steals Jenkin's girlfriend. And he says, "You have to make sure my horse takes no cold in his feet. You have to make him stand on your cloak." And Jenkin does make the horse stand on his cloak. But in order to spite the guy, he cuts four holes in his cloak and makes the horse stand on the ground. Because, like, that'll show him.
We've got one more little thingette to look at. And that's your one-line pitch. Again, it's a free-for-all. Anyone can jump in with their if it's a pitch meeting. All I've got is it's Robin Hood meets Georgia Green. That's all I've got. That's all I've got for a pitch meeting. Film poster, everything I do it for George? No? No? Okay. For the good of all men and for the love of one woman, he fought to uphold justice by breaking the law. I will keep putting
in
Robin Hood. I will keep putting in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves gags for as long as we can. Your one-line pitches, what have you got?
Georgia Green, the occasional snog and a lot of stick.
Stupid comedy and quarterstaff fights. You know you love it.
Alexandra.
It's not exactly a single line, but the moment that includes the line that we have not read out from the chat, which is, the line is, "A fart for the pound and a fart for Georgia Green," the pound being where he impounds the animals. I feel as though that moment somehow, hopefully that line, but that moment needs to be the one-line pitch, the inner world where a fart for Georgia Green.
Excellent. So we're still working our way through the format. We're still playing around. We may in the future have some additional guests, different plays coming up. So patrons and podcast listeners at home, what questions should we be asking about these plays? What plays do you want to see us do next? Are there any special guests you'd like to have us on? Like we have any control over that whatsoever. But never mind. Answers on a postcard, admin@beyondshakespeare.org, or you can follow us, comment at us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. It's always at Beyond Shakes. And if you want to become a patron, that's cool. If you're interested in seeing Georgia Green, just Georgia Green happening, there should be a super specific PayPal link that will be in the show notes to this episode, so that if you wanted to contribute to a seed funding work on Georgia Green, then you can do that as well. And as you may or may not have seen earlier, there always are plans for specific merchandise for individual plays, and you can purchase that, and that will go into the Georgia Green coffers to some degree, even if it's just to start work on small elements of a future production, help to promote it, build its general interest in the world. We've done two exploring sessions on it so far. We really want to come back to it. And all that remains is for us to say goodbye.
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 Thank you and goodbye.
Coming soon to your imagination now, Georgia Green, the Pinner of Wakefield.
Seest thou these seals? Eat them, or eat my dagger's point, proud squire.
I'll baste you both so well you were never better basted.
Whose pretty boy art thou?
A fart for the pound and a fart for Georgia Green.
Stupid comedy and quarterstaff fights. You know you love it.
For see, I have a large commission.
Georgia Green, the occasional snog and a lot of stick.
It isn't easy being Georgia Green.
Can't come read with us. It is fun.